Monthly Weather Review, 1923, page 316, that, away from this earth, the temperature falls only to a height of about 7 miles, where it is from 60 to 70 degrees below zero, Fahrenheit. But from this altitude to as high as balloons have gone, which is about 15 miles, the temperature has remained about the same. It is said that, according to observations upon light effects of meteor trains, there are reasons for thinking that, in their zone of from 30 to 50 miles above this Earth's surface, conditions are mild, or not even freezing. For data that may indicate, in another field of observations, that, not enormously far away, there is a shell around this Earth, see the newspapers of August 20, 1925. According to data collected by the Naval Research Laboratory, there is something, somewhere in the sky, that is deflecting electromagnetic waves of wireless communications, in a way that is similar to the way in which sound waves are sent back by the dome of the Capitol, at Washington. The published explanation is that there is an ionized zone around this Earth. Those waves are rebounding from something. More was published in the newspapers, May 21, 1927. The existence of a ceiling in the sky had been verified by experiments at Carnegie Institution. September 5, 1930, a paper read by Professor E. V. Appleton, at a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science. The ionized zone is not satisfactory. The subject is as puzzling as it is fascinating, and no decisive answer to the problem can be given at present. From Norway had been reported experiments upon shortwave transmissions, which had been reflected back to this Earth. They had come back, as if from a shell-like formation, around this Earth, not unthinkably far away. Wild talents. 1. You know, I can only surmise about this, but John Henry Sanders, of 75 Colville Street, Derby, England, was the proprietor of a fish store, and I think that it was a small business. His wife helped. When I read of helpful wives, I take it that that means that husbands haven't large businesses. If Mrs. Sanders went about, shedding scales in her intercourses, I deduce that theirs wasn't much of a fish business. Upon the evening of March 4, 1905, in the Sanders home, in the bedroom of their housemaid, there was a fire. Nobody was at home, and the fireman had to break in. There was no fireplace in the bedroom. Not a trace of anything by which to explain was found, and the fireman reported, origin unknown. They returned to their station, and were immediately called back to this house. There was another fire. It was in another bedroom. Again, origin unknown. The Sanders, in their fish store, were notified, and they hastened home. Money was missed. Many things were missed. The housemaid, Emma Piggott, was suspected. In her parents' home was found a box, from which the Sanders took, and identified as theirs, £5, and a loot of such things as a carving set, sugar tongs, tablecloths, several dozen handkerchiefs, salt spoons, bottles of scent, curtain hooks, a hairbrush, Turkish towels, gloves, a sponge, two watches, a puff box. The girl was arrested, and in the Derby Borough Police Court, she was charged with arson and larceny. She admitted the thefts, but asserted her innocence of the fires. There was clearly such an appearance of relation between the thefts and the fires, which, if they had burned down the house, would have covered the thefts, that both charges were pressed. It is not only that there had been thefts, and then fires, so many things had been stolen that unless the home of the Sanders was a large household, some of these things would have been missed unless all had been stolen at once. I have no datum for thinking that the Sanders lived upon any such scale as one in which valuables could have been stolen, from time to time, unknown to them. The indications were of one wide grab, and the girl's intention to set the house afire, to cover it. Emma Piggott's lawyer showed that she had been nowhere near the house, at the time of the first fire, and that, when the second fire broke out, she, in the street, this off evening of hers, returning, had called the attention of neighbors to smoke coming from a window. The case was too complicated for a police court, and was put off for the summer assizes. Derby Mercury, July 19. Trial of the girl resumed. The prosecution maintained that the fires could be explained only as of incendiary origin, and that the girl's motive for setting the house afire was plain, and that she had plundered so recklessly, because she had planned a general destruction, by which anything missing would be accounted for. Again, counsel for the defense showed that the girl could not have started the fires. The charge of arson was dropped. Emma Piggott was sentenced to 6 months hard labor, for the thefts. Upon December 2, 1919, Ambrose Small, of Toronto, Canada, disappeared. He was known to have been in his office, in the Toronto Grand Opera House, of which he was the owner, between 5 and 6 o'clock, the evening of December 2. Nobody saw him leave his office. Nobody, at least nobody whose testimony can be accepted, saw him, this evening, outside the building. There were stories of a woman in the case. But Ambrose Small disappeared, and left more than $1 million behind. Then John Doughty, Small's secretary, vanished. Small's safe deposit boxes were opened by Mrs. Small and other trustees of the estate. In the boxes were securities, valued at $1,125,000. An inventory was found. According to it, the sum of $105,000 was missing. There was an investigation, and bonds of the value of $105,000 were found, hidden in the home of Doughty's sister. All over the world, the disappearance of Ambrose Small was advertised, with offers of reward, in acres of newspaper space. He was in his office. He vanished. Doughty, too, was sought. He had not only vanished, he had done all that he could to be unfindable. But he was traced to a town in Oregon, where he was living under the name of Cooper. He was taken back to Toronto, where he was indicted, charged with having stolen the bonds, and with having abducted Small, to cover the thefts. It was the contention of the prosecution that Ambrose Small, wealthy, in good health, and with no known troubles of any importance, had no motive to vanish, and to leave $1,125,000 behind, but that his secretary, the embezzler, did have a motive for abducting him. The prosecution did not charge that Small had been soundlessly and invisibly picked out of his office, where he was surrounded by assistants. The attempt was to show that he had left his office, even though nobody had seen him go. Thinkably, he could have been abducted, unwitnessed, in a street. A newsboy testified that he had seen Small, in a nearby street, between 5 and 6 o'clock, evening of December 2, but the boy's father contradicted the story. Another newsboy told that, upon this evening, after 6 o'clock, Small had bought a newspaper from him, but, under examination, this boy admitted he was not sure of the date. It seemed clear that there was relation between the embezzlement and the disappearance, which, were it not for the inventory, would have covered the thefts, but the accusation of abduction failed. Doughty was found guilty of embezzlement, and was sentenced to 6 years' imprisonment in the Kingston Penitentiary. In the News of the World, London, June 6, 1926, there is an account of strangely intertwined circumstances. In a public place, in the daytime, a man had died. On the footway, outside the Gaiety Theatre, London, Henry Arthur Chappelle, the manager of the refreshment department of the theatre, had been found dead. There was a post-mortem examination by a well-known pathologist, Professor Piney. The man's skull was fractured. Professor Piney gave his opinion that, if, because of heart failure, Chappelle had fallen backward, the fractured skull might be accounted for, but he added that, though he had found indications of a slight affection of the heart, it was not such as would be likely to cause fainting. The indications were that a murder had been committed. The police inquired into the matter, and learned that not long before there had been trouble. A girl, Rose Smith, employed at one of the refreshment counters, had been discharged by Chappelle. One night she had placed on his doorstep a note telling that she intended to kill herself. Several nights later, she was arrested in Chappelle's back garden. She was dressed in a man's clothes, and had a knife. Also, she carried matches and a bottle of paraffin. Presumably she was bent upon murder and arson, but she was charged with trespassing, and was sentenced to 2 months hard labor. It was learned that Chappelle had died upon the day of this girl's release from prison. Rose Smith was arrested. Chappelle had no other known enemy. Upon the day of this girl's release, he had died. But the accusation failed. A police inspector testified that, at the time of Chappelle's death, Rose Smith had been in the prisoner's aid home. 2. I am a collector of notes upon subjects that have diversity, such as deviations from concentricity in the lunar crater Copernicus, and a sudden appearance of purple Englishman stationary meteor radiance, and a reported growth of hair on the bald head of a mummy and did the girl swallow the octopus. But my liveliest interest is not so much in things, as in relations of things. I have spent much time thinking about the alleged pseudo-relations that are called coincidences. What if some of them should not be coincidences? Ambrose Small disappeared, and to only one person could be attributed a motive for his disappearance. Only to one person's motives could the fires in the house in Derby be attributed. Only to one person's motives could be attributed the probable murder of Henry Chappelle. But, according to the verdicts in all these cases, the meaning of all is of nothing but coincidence between motives and events.